This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
This is Jay Stowe with the next installment of Esquire's March 2024 issue, the one with Austin Butler on the cover. We're going to jump back into the feature story, the profile of Reverend Al Sharpton. The headline is just Rev, and I'll remind you what the subhead is. To one America, he has long been a beacon of the civil rights movement. The man met Dr. King. To another, he was a loudmouth in a tracksuit, surrounded by controversy and shady friends. The man knows Don King, too. Pulitzer Prize winner Mitchell S. Jackson tailed Al Sharpton around the country to find out why he keeps going, what he's still doing, and where his place in history will be. Sharpton spent the 80s marching, agitating, protesting, building relationships with sundry figures. Don King, Michael Jackson, and Donald Trump, a man he now describes as a, quote, polished bigot, unquote. In 1984, Bernard Goetz, a white man, shot four black teenagers on the subway. He claimed he was afraid they were going to mug him. And Sharpton's activism played a role in Goetz's being convicted of illegal possession of a firearm. Sharpton's breakthrough happened 2 years after the shooting. Three black men had been beaten in Howard Beach, Queens, and one of them, in trying to escape, ran onto the Belt Parkway and was hit by a car and killed. Howard Beach was the first time Sharpton took his protest to a white neighborhood, a tactic that disabused more people of the lie that virulent racism was less of an issue in New York. Three of the white attackers were convicted of second-degree manslaughter. Sharpton, with a showman's knack for hyperbole, later proclaimed it, quote, the first public awakening of Northern racism, unquote. During the trial for Howard Beach in 1987, Sharpton became involved in the case of Tawana Brawley, a 15-year-old girl who told a disturbing story about being abducted and raped multiple times by six white men, including a cop and an assistant DA. Sharpton and her lawyers alleged a cover-up and discouraged Brawley from testifying. But after several months, testimony that amounted to 6,000 pages and 180 witnesses, a grand jury ruled her claim false. Sharpton didn't concede. Not after the verdict. Not after Brawley's ex-boyfriend claimed she'd invented the story to avoid being beaten for running away. Not after he lost a defamation case. A group of his supporters paid $65,000 in damages to the former assistant DA. Not in the almost 40 intervening years. I believed a young lady and her mother and two lawyers, a risk that I took in the 30-something years since then, he tells me. How do I know that they weren't going to come with something on George Floyd? How did I know they wasn't going to come with something on Trayvon? And if the hardest knock they can give me in my career is that I believed a little girl whose mother told her story and two lawyers told me it was right, I'll take that. I'll take that. But Brawley remains a major blemish on his career, one that provokes fair questions. Why did he go so hard for her? Was he chasing notoriety at the expense of truth? Isn't believing a possible but somewhat specious story in a charged moment different from remaining adamant after overwhelming evidence in the benefit of hindsight? Why hasn't he expressed serious contrition? Is it ego holding him back? Hubris? Isn't there wisdom, kindness, grace in offering an apology? Whatever you think about Sharpton's handling of the Brawley case, though, consider how often a man in his position has had to believe in what sounded impossible. Consider the truth that he spent his adult life fighting injustice, too often at the hands of law enforcement. Consider the childhood trauma of his father deserting the family when he was 10, plunging him, his sister, and their mother into poverty, and forging Sharpton into his mother's fierce protector. Consider the cultural imperative for black men to protect our women, so much so that it was once the namesake of proposed legislation. Consider that Sharpton was a brand new father at the time, that he would return home to Ashley as an infant and Dominique not long out of infancy. However much you disapprove of Sharpton's defiance in the Brawley ordeal, weigh it against his evolution since then. Begin, maybe, with this watershed in 1991. Sharpton was stabbed while preparing to protest the murder of Yusef Hawkins, a black teen who'd been attacked, shot, and killed by a white mob in Bensonhurst, Brooklyn. There's still too much racism in the country, he told Jesse Jackson from his hospital bed. And if I survive, I hope I'm going to be even more serious now in the true King tradition of opposing it. Sharpton ran for U.S. Senate in 1992 and 1994. He ran for mayor of New York City in 1997. He ran for president in 2004. He lost all those elections, which wasn't no big old surprise to him or anybody, really. But he won a preponderance of the black vote and nearly 15% of all Democratic primary votes cast, 166,000 out of 1.2 million. In his 1992 bid, and more than 25%, 178,000 out of 700,000 in 1994, all achieved with budgets of $100,000 or less both times, and quantified himself as a legitimate political force. Sharpton, for all his old bluster, has remained true to MLK's central tenet of nonviolence. He's become a popular TV pundit and radio host. He might well be the most esteemed eulogist in Black America. He helped organize a rally in support of George Floyd during the pandemic that he estimates at 200,000, the accomplishment that makes him most proud. What if Sharpton's ultimate legacy is not some omnibus writ that the ill-intentioned, looking at you, SCOTUS, will work lifetimes to dismantle, but his indefatigable insistence? He logs a staggering 250,000 to 300,000 air miles per year on the overtruth that there never has been nor will be a post-racial America, least of all in the city that is its locus of power. It's not the bright, tangible achievements of his forebears, but the difficult, often fallible work of steadying a light that won't let you look away. Mount Vernon, New York, June 11th, 2023. Sharpton has agreed to fill in for the pastor of Greater Centennial AME Zion Church in Mount Vernon, New York, and arrives preacher clean in a gray suit, a light blue French cuff shirt, links, his trusty NAN lapel pin. Before the sermon, he hosts his radio show, Sunday Morning with Reverend Al Sharpton, in a small conference room. The second he signs off, Sharpton turns to the Reverend Malcolm J. Byrd, a protege, and says, Bible. Sharpton spends a few minutes, tops, looking over pages. Okay, ready, he says. He sits in a velvet chair in an elevated pulpit, nodding to the mellifluous sound of the choir behind him. Reverend Byrd introduces him as the finest preacher south of heaven and north of hell, and a spokesperson of truth and liberation of the first magnitude. What seems an impossible promise. Sharpton preaches a sermon that ends with a story about letting a white reporter accompany him to church while profiling him. He says a reporter asked him about a woman in the congregation who kept leaning over in the pews like she was going to fall, then snapping straight. Oh, you don't know that lady's story? Sharpton says, switching to the drawn-out delivery of a southern whooping preacher. That woman brought herself up from the South. She got married. Her and her husband had a little construction company. They did well and moved out to a middle-class section of Queens, New York. Used to buy a Cadillac every year. One day she woke up and her husband had walked out with her daughter from an earlier marriage. He had a child with his stepdaughter. Abandoned her and her little boy and her little girl. She ended up watching them come and take the Cadillac back. She tried to keep the bills going, but they turned the lights and gas off. She couldn't pay the utilities. Finally, she couldn't keep the house any longer. She had to move into the heart of the ghetto. She got on welfare and got food stamps. Did side jobs as a domestic worker. Her little boy would walk her to the subway to go downtown to scrub floors. And she would tell him, "Don't worry about nothing. God will make a way. I don't know where, I don't know how, but God will make a way somehow." And she lived to see that little girl and that little boy grow up to be somebody. And when she thinks about how she lost everything but God, but God brought her through anyhow and brought her children through, her little girl and her little boy through, she jumps up out of her seat, leans to the side, and just jumps up and down, Sharpton says, and mimics the motion. And the reason I know her story is because I'm her little boy, he says. And in one of the sublimities of the black church, the organist stresses his pause as if it had been rehearsed. He walks with me, he shouts, no more organ accompaniment. He talks with me. He tells me that I'm his own. God will, God will, God will make a way. Sharpton wings his arms and points to the front row. Yes, he will. Yes, he will, he says, and steps away from the mic. No thank you, no pause to relish applause. Just an abrupt turn from the lectern, his hallmark. Sharpton home, June 11th, 2023. Sharpton answers the door to his apartment on the Upper East Side of Manhattan, wearing a dress shirt, unbuttoned at the throat but tucked into his slacks, and slides with socked feet. Per public records, NAN paid Sharpton just shy of $650,000 in compensation as its CEO and president in 2021, plus spent almost $1 million more on private jets and car service. That income, combined with his salary from MSNBC, his talk show, Politics Nation, often boasts the highest concentration of black viewers on cable news, radio gigs, and speaking fees, places Sharpton in the top 1% of American earners. He leads me outside to show me the view from his wraparound balcony, a remarkable sight, which is furnished with a small couch and a low table. He tours me past the office of his partner, 45-year-old fashion designer Aisha McShaw, with whom he made his relationship public in 2013. Sharpton's home office is like another vault of his archives. Above the desk hangs an old program, the kind some churches give out, advertising, quote, "The Reverend Alfred Sharpton Jr., a dynamic 7-year-old minister," unquote. There's a picture of Sharpton with his father, both dressed in church robes, a picture of his first grandson alongside his older daughter and the boy's father, a picture of Sharpton holding his grandson, the boy decked out in a paperboy hat and with his fist in Sharpton's mouth, a picture of him with James Brown, back when Sharpton had an afro, both smiling and raising a black power fist, a picture from 1971 when he participated in a sit-in at an A&P, a picture of him on Saturday Night Live. There's a stack of headbands just above his desk. At his dining room table, the sound of his TV playing an MSNBC show in the background, Sharpton tells me about the men who shaped him. There would be no Reverend Al Sharpton without Bishop Frederick Douglass Washington, who was not only one of the most well-regarded Pentecostal preachers in the country, but the pastor of Sharpton's childhood church. Bishop Washington, a former boyhood preacher himself, allowed Sharpton to preach in public for the first time, July 9, 1959, and thereafter became his first mentor, someone who encouraged him to preach once a month and modeled the reading practice of a philomath. See the influence of Bishop Washington's preaching style. It ranged from sound homiletics to the high emotion of the Southern whooping tradition, in the way Sharpton commands a pulpit. There would be no Sharpton without Adam Clayton Powell Jr. Sharpton met Powell at his church, the historic Abyssinian Baptist, when he was 12 years old, an experience that made him think he'd, quote, seen God, unquote. Powell began letting young Sharpton tag along while he held court around the city with everybody from the New York elites to its poor. Powell was a statesman and a pioneer of civil rights. He led a bus boycott in Harlem 14 years before MLK did in Montgomery. He was irreverent to white power and had a flair for flamboyance. See Powell's influence in how Sharpton has navigated the cultural and political milieu of New York in his unabashed boldness. Wouldn't be an Al Sharpton without Jesse Jackson, whom he met as a teen when Jackson came to New York for a rally and the ribbon cutting of the city's Operation Breadbasket office. Jackson was the organization's national director and had established Saturday morning rallies in Chicago, which drew thousands each week to hear him preach in person and on the radio. He was also, Sharpton noticed, full of swagger, at one point sporting a huge afro and a medallion, a young man who in many ways eschewed the aesthetic values of the older civil rights leaders. See Jackson's model in the fact that Sharpton has never pastored his own church, in the existence of his Saturday Action rally, in the track suits and medallions Sharpton wore for decades, a defiance, too, of what a leader should look like. See it in how Sharpton struts around to handle his business. There would be no Al Sharpton without Martin Luther King Jr. While Sharpton never spent significant time with MLK, as a boy he met him in Brooklyn while King was convalescing from a stab wound, later saw him preach at Washington Temple, and ended up working as the youth director of the New York chapter of MLK's Operation Breadbasket. Still, MLK's most enduring impact on Sharpton was posthumous. Sharpton was home watching TV with his mother the night that news of King's assassination aired, and it made her weep as though she'd lost a family member. Sharpton asked his mother why she was so emotional. "You would have had to have grown up in Alabama, Dothan, like me, and sit in the back of the bus or have to use the bathroom, and you wasn't allowed to understand what Martin Luther King meant to me," she said. Sharpton decided that moment he wanted to matter like that. The evolved version of Al Sharpton wouldn't exist without Harry Belafonte, a man Sharpton befriended as an adult. By then, Belafonte, who was one of the movement's chief funders, had long been considered a giant of civil rights, esteem evident in his regal bearing. Belafonte would often advise Sharpton that the more he mattered, the more people would scrutinize his words, and therefore Sharpton needed to commit to perfection. That impossible pursuit, the greater consideration of his words, the self-possession of a man who believes he's earned his status, count them as the Belafonte effect. Believe you me, there would be no Sharpton without James Brown, whom he met in 1973 after Brown's son died in the car wreck. Brown's fundraiser for the National Youth Movement was a big, big deal for Sharpton, whose parents loved the singer. "And if I thought I saw God with Adam Clayton Powell, I was sure I saw God with James Brown," Sharpton recalls. The night they met, Brown told Sharpton that if he listened to him, he'd make him, quote, a big man, unquote, would help him get, quote, the whole hog, unquote. He told him to use every opportunity to be seen, that Sharpton couldn't help the cause if nobody knew who he was. From Brown, quote, the hardest working man in show business, unquote, Sharpton learned assiduousness and showmanship. From Brown, he learned crucial lessons in survival and what it takes for real, to keep the fifth commandment, honor thy father. On that subject, a confession. Until I met him, I was super judgmental of Sharpton's conk, deemed it rooted in my culture's self-degrading, closer to white notion of good hair, not to mention an almost laughable anachronism. The conk should have been left to Sammy Davis Jr. and Bo Diddley and Chuck Berry and Little Richard and the Temptations. The conk should have never lived past the heyday of the Godfather of Soul. Which brings me to the story Sharpton told me about his indelible hairdo, which these days is swooped back over a thinning crown and silver, with remnants of brown at the edges. So it goes. In 1982, Sharpton was headed to participate in marches aimed at turning MLK's birthday into a national holiday, but stopped to visit Brown in Georgia. He told Brown, almost as a dare, that he should ring President Reagan to help the cause. The call yielded an invite to meet Reagan and Vice President Bush on King's birthday. Brown accepted on the condition he could bring Sharpton. Brown demanded Sharpton fly with him to D.C. Once there, he asked Sharpton for a favor. "When we land, I'm going to take you by Bobby Bennett of the Famous Flames," one of Brown's old backup singers, and I want you do to your hair like mine," said Brown. "We going to the White House tomorrow, and we're going to be doing a lot of press, and I want when they see you, they see me. I want you to be a reflection of me." The next morning, January 15th, Sharpton and Brown strolled into the White House, Sharpton's first time, and met with Reagan and Bush, a visit that made national headlines and helped realize MLK Day into a federal holiday. "Reverend," said Brown on the flight back to Augusta, "I want you to do me one more favor. I want you to keep your hair like that as long as I'm alive." When Brown died, Sharpton flew to Augusta to help with the arrangements. He scheduled one of the memorials at the Apollo Theater, and the 11th hour, Brown's daughters picked a gold casket that was too heavy to fly in the singer's private plane. The undertaker presented a workaround. Drive Brown's gilded coffin to the almost 800 miles. Sharpton insisted on riding along with him. Picture Sharpton riding the whole time with his arm over the casket. Picture his conk a little messy yet nonetheless styled like that of the man he considered his father. Sharpton never not conked since 1982. Come to find out, the conk is a commitment. Is Sharpton honoring a lifelong pledge beyond life? Shame on my ignorant arrogance when, after all, and maybe above all judgment, the man's conk is worthy of my respect. Ocala, Florida, June 12, 2023. Sharpton landed in Orlando around midnight and still managed to work out at 5 a.m. to meet his main goal of burning 90 calories, a slight figure for some, but for a man who home scales himself every day and ranges between 133 and 134 pounds. This for someone who once weighed over 300. It's plenty. At 9 o'clock, several SUVs pull up outside the hotel to take the Sharpton retinue on the hour or so drive to Ocala for the funeral of Ejike A.J. Owens, a mother shot through a door by her white neighbor for defending her children. On the ride, Sharpton makes plans to have his kale salad and green juice delivered to his house. He sips from a bottle of blue Listerine, swishes, and spits in a cup. He orders the AC off to protect his voice. He also nods to sleep, the first time I've seen him rest during my commute. Meadowbrook is a megachurch with a sprawling parking lot, and there's some confusion about where to park. When the driver makes it at last to the right building, Meadowbrook's pastor receives us. If anyone's surprised that the pastor is a white man, no one says it. He and Sharpton enter the building side by side, the pastor informing him that the family would like to meet with him. Since Sharpton only attends funerals he's been invited to, this happens almost everywhere, the family wanting to meet with him. It has got to the point where if an unarmed black American is killed and Sharpton isn't there, you might not ever hear about it, or might wonder where he is if you have heard. Sharpton's presence is a message writ large that what happened deserves national attention, and I suspect his presence also affirms for the people who loved and cared about the victim that, however brief, this black life was of consequence to more than just them. The pastor leads us into the small office of his junior pastor. Sharpton asks for a funeral program and reads it while standing. Word soon arrives that Ben Crump, the civil rights attorney, who, like Sharpton, also seems to be in every city where a black person is shot or neck-heeled or paralyzed in the back of a police van, will escort him to meet the family. "Hey, mentor," he greets Sharpton, leads him into a children's recreation room that's been repurposed as a convening room for the family. AJ's four children and her mother are in the room. All are dressed in white and lavender, the boys in suits, the mother in a dress with a little flower and a lilac ribbon pinned to it. Crump introduces Sharpton to AJ's mother, Pamela Diaz, who is old enough to have a daughter who died at 35 but doesn't look much older than that herself. Diaz's hair is done in neat braids and pulled into a high bun. A pulse after she meets Sharpton. She lays her head on his shoulder and closes her eyes. It's a moving sight. This mother in her grief, seeking immediate consolation from a stranger. Only Sharpton isn't a stranger to her, not to any black person who's lost someone in extralegal violence. He's a father figure, an uncle, an elder, someone notable for fighting for the underdogs, 5 decades plus. And this, what he's doing now, showing up, receiving a head on his shoulder, could be perhaps the biggest piece of his legacy. A contingent of clergy attending the funerals of high-profile victims is not new. Several preachers and state officials showed up to the funeral of Emmett Till, albeit back then those preachers tended to be local and seemed to have a more intimate connection to the people involved. Pastor A.R. Bernard of the Brooklyn Megachurch Christian Cultural Center leads the family in prayer, calling for us to link hands and bow our heads. Hearing the weeping under his words makes me feel obscene, as if I've intruded on the intimate grief of these people. While I'm sad about AJ's death, she's also a stranger to me, a fact that makes me question the measure of my bereavement, how real it is. Sharpton will share that when he looks at the bodies, he realizes they could be one of his daughters or his grandson. He reflects on the fact that, if not for the grace of God, it could have been him. "I may not know the individuals," he says, "but I know the experience." In introducing Sharpton, the Reverend R.B. Holmes, who runs the Tallahassee chapter of NAN, derides the cameras present, a blatant jab at Sharpton, Crump, and others he believes are here for the publicity. "We didn't come for the cameras," Sharpton says near the opening of his eulogy. "But if we come and help you get here, I want you cameras to show up. I don't apologize for that. Because the world needs to know that we shouldn't be at a funeral this morning." He points to AJ's open casket below him. "They want to bury what happened to AJ, but we're not going to let them bury it. We're not going to be quiet about it. We're not going to apologize for it. What happened to this family is wrong, and we come to stand with this family to call wrong, wrong." Sharpton addresses AJ's oldest son, Isaac, who believes his mother wouldn't have died if not for him. "Don't feel guilty about nothing. Your mother chose to stand in danger's way for you. She chose you over her. That's what mothers do," Sharpton says. "Isaac, Israel, Africa, Titus, don't grow up feeling guilty." The crowd amens and booms applause louder than at my other point, at any other point. I want you to go and be everything she wanted you to be, he tells Isaac. I want you to go on to college, and I want your brothers and sisters to be something. And if you don't have any money, call me and say, you showed up at my mother's funeral. I need to go to college. Just like I showed up today for you. I want to show up at your graduation. And I want you to put your fist in the air and say, I'm AJ's boy. The eulogy includes Sharpton rebutting people who tell him to preach the word but stay away from civil rights and politics. Well, maybe you got a different Bible than I got, he says, picking up his Bible and shaking it. Because in my Bible, the second book was about the exodus of slaves from slavery. My Bible had David made king. That's political. Solomon made king. That's political. Esther went against the genocide of her whole people. If you take all that out of the Bible, you ain't got much left. I was not born at a time when they walked to the Red Sea, he shouts. I wasn't born at a time when they went to the Jordan. I wasn't there when Goliath mocked the Israeli army. But I was there when they shot Trayvon. I was there when they choked Eric Garner. I was around when they put their knee on George Floyd's neck. And I was around when you shot through the door at AJ. New Orleans, June 30th to July 3rd, 2023. The Essence Festival, which began as an intended one-time event to commemorate the 25th anniversary of Essence Magazine in 1995, is now billed as the largest black cultural and music event in the country. Today, it's a concert series. It's a cultural forum. It's parties upon parties. A place for black folks to gather, from nine-to-fivers who save and scrimp for a weekend vacay to the black elite, celebs included, who are part of its billing. The festival and the city of New Orleans treat Sharpton, who has attended every Essence Festival since it began, like a dignitary, providing him two chauffeured SUVs and a police detail. Everywhere he goes, a squad car with its turrets flashing and sirens blaring leads the way. And I think we're going to have to leave it there for now, but we will pick up and finish off Mitchell S. Jackson's profile of Reverend Al Sharpton next week and move on with the rest of this issue. Until then, this is Jay Stowe signing off. Have a great week.